Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by Fluke Hearing, finding ways to help people hear like nature intended, with 16 locations including Lansing, Jackson, Grand Rapids, and Ann Arbor. FlukeHearing.com.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. It is Tuesday, the 19th of March. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you're here. You can reach us at currentstate@wkar.org. Democratic State Representative Sam Singh of East Lansing sits on the House Appropriations Committee and Education Appropriations Subcommittees, and we welcome back the first-termer to Current State to get his thoughts on, oh my goodness, let's see here, education, Blue Cross Blue Shield, sequestration, and the list goes on and on. How are you, Sam? Good to see you.
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me back.
Good. I'm just learning about a new higher education bill that includes sanctions for new union contracts involving teachers and faculty. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. And this is the strange part of being in this process. I've been on the subcommittee. We've been discussing this. I did not receive this bill until 8 o'clock this morning. I've been waiting to be able to see it. As you know, I have a committee meeting at 10:30 this morning, which I'm now supposed to react to this bill, put forward amendments. And again, it's the kind of games that get played at the state capitol, unfortunately.
Okay.
This information was available. They probably could have given it to us at the end of last week, but because they want to give it at the last minute, it creates this kind of tension and unfortunate. But you're absolutely right. We've got this bill dropped that would cut 15% of any university that didn't meet their funding formula for employee contract funding. And this could be even contracts that have already been dealt with, who this hasn't even gone to the full Appropriations Committee nor been voted on by the legislature. They would be going retroactive and hurting institutions. So we heard testimony last week from Wayne State University, which their new contract actually saves the taxpayers $10 million. They have the potential of losing $27 million if this new budget goes through the way the Republicans have dealt with it. It's shocking, and it's not good policy, and it's not good for us positioning ourselves in a global economy.
Whose measure is it? Do you know?
Well, it's being presented today by the chair, Representative Al Pashoka, but my understanding is that this has been a leadership conversation by the Republican Party in the State House.
And he is on the House Education Committee, correct?
He's the chairman of the House Subcommittee of Higher Education.
Okay.
And so this was the material I received again at 8 o'clock today, cutting every institution by 15% if they don't meet these arbitrary employee contract funding rules that have just been dropped by the chairman today.
And do you? And this is all unfolding so quickly here as we speak. Are you aware of any response from Michigan State University?
Well, my understanding is that Michigan State University did not have any contracts that were being looked at this point in time. Again, this goes back to the right to work conversation from last year. Those employee contracts have until March 27th to be dealt with. And my understanding is that Michigan State did not have any contracts. It was really Wayne State and the University of Michigan. But that's two of our three research institutions, our top-tier institutions that could be receiving a 15% cut on top of the 15% cut that the governor gave them 2 years before. This isn't good policy. This isn't positioning these institutions to be the global leaders that they're supposed to be.
And this also puts the issue of legislative process back in front of everybody, not that far on the heels of right to work.
Right. And again, it's unfortunate. Again, if these universities are actually saving money, they're actually in a very strong position to be bargaining with their unions. They actually have an upper hand as management to be actually getting these concessions. Wayne State got a number of great concessions according to management. They got $10 million of health care savings. They got lower costs of raises over the years. 4 years. They also got teacher tenure. So if a faculty member wasn't doing a good job, it's easier for them to remove them. Again, these are reforms that have been asked for by the Republican Party for years. They're being instituted, but now they're going to be penalized because it might extend a contract a little bit longer for some of those unions.
Okay. And you sit on this committee with Representative Pasholka?
I do. I'm the vice chair representing the Democratic Party.
Okay. All right. We will keep our eyes on that today. We haven't spoken since, speaking of education, we haven't spoken since Gretchen Whitmer and other members of your party announced that the Michigan 2020 plan is the Democrats' highest legislative priority this year. This would fund some college for every Michigan high school graduate. How much discussion is there of this at the Capitol, and what's the tone of that discussion?
You know, unfortunately, there's not enough conversation happening about this. Again, this is being led by the Senate and by Senator Whitmer. It's a reintroduction of the conversation they started last term, and it's good policy for the state of Michigan. Again, the states that are most successful in a global economy have educated people with bachelor's and master's degrees. Right now, as you've seen, the cost of tuition go up over the past decade. The state involvement, again, 2 years ago, we cut 15%. So again, tuition has been going up year after year. And for us to be able to help our young people get those degrees that they need to be positioned in a global economy, you need to be bold. And this program is bold. I know that there's another program on the House side that Representative Andy Shore introduced that would be providing loan forgiveness for those who graduate and so forth. So there's a number of these types of conversations. But again, the states as well as the countries that have the most educated workforce are going to be the most successful in the global economy. So we should be talking about this. And unfortunately, that's not the conversations we're having. We're going back to what we talked about earlier, making cuts because groups have extended a contract with one of their employee groups.
What's intrigued me about the Michigan 2020 plan from the get-go, and this goes back a year, almost a year and a half ago now, with conversations I had with Gretchen Whitmer, is the method for funding this. This would rely on a consensus elimination of tax breaks to come up with, I believe, $1.8 billion to cover all of these things. What's your understanding of how that? Are you far enough into it to comment on that consensus elimination of tax breaks to pay for this?
Well, again, you know, that I think is about a 10% cut of the $3.5 billion worth of tax breaks that are and tax loopholes that the senator has talked about reducing. Again, we should be having these conversations. Unfortunately, the Republicans are not more talking about how we make cuts to these budgets versus about how we expand the opportunity for our students to attend the university. So I think, unfortunately, where I've seen this go is absolutely nowhere. It's a good idea. It's a good policy. We should be debating this. And unfortunately, we've not seen that.
The Blue Cross Blue Shield has been on the table here for quite some time. The governor just signed the measure into law yesterday. Were you a supporter of the measure that cleared the House?
The measure that cleared the House that finally got ratification, I did support. Over the period of time, I had some strong concerns. There was a set of dollars and resources that Blue Cross Blue Shield, because of the type of corporation it was prior to these changes, was paying for Medigap coverage for seniors. What we did in the compromise bill was fully fund that Medigap coverage for 4 years, and then there's a trailing amount of dollars and resources beyond that. What I've said to my colleagues, the challenge for me over the next 4 years is to help find how we deal with that Medigap coverage in the future. So I think there was some, you know, strong desire to help make the transition for Blue Cross Blue Shield into this nonprofit mutual. They're now paying significant taxes to the state of Michigan. It actually levels the playing field for a number of insurance companies. And so we saw these things as being positive. The most specific thing was that it was going to reduce some funding that was going to seniors. We were able to get 4 years of that funding covered. But from this point on, we have to find additional resources to make sure that we keep the senior citizens who are relying on this coverage whole.
So you heard the criticism of that policy, of this concern over seniors, but you're confident that that can be addressed after 4 years.
Well, again, when you look at what was passed last cycle, it didn't have these same protections and the same level of support. The reason I came to the support was that we provided a pathway for funding for 4 years. And now, again, it's the task for me and all the legislators and the governor to find additional resources. Now, we have new Medicaid expansion conversations that are happening right now that free up some dollars. And I'm hopeful that we can look at some of those things as we move forward. But it's definitely a conversation that we have to look at in earnest.
We're talking with East Lansing State Representative Sam Singh. You and Lansing Representative Andy Shore are speaking up tomorrow about the impact of sequestration. This seems to have been fairly murky. Everyone has needed some time to sort out just exactly what the impact of sequestration will be on mid-Michigan. How closely have you looked at this?
Well, we've been looking at it, and again, you know, it all depends on what actually transpires over the next few months. If nothing happens, where there's just complete cuts, you know, we're going to see a significant impact things across the country. Specifically, I've been looking at it because I'm also on the Department of Education budget for appropriations, and we will lose 2,300 students who would be in Head Start. We would lose 900 families who had access to child care. You'd have hundreds of teachers laid off because of these resources, and special ed funding that comes from the federal government would be reduced as well. Again, there is hope if Republicans and Democrats in Washington, D.C. can actually have a serious conversation. And so what we're trying to do is put a spotlight on this to say, listen, we understand that there's a lot of political games that are happening in Washington, D.C., but our local communities will suffer because of this. We're asking them to come together, work together, and make sure that we keep our communities whole. Make sure that we don't have these education cuts. Make sure that some of the other cuts that are coming to our communities, to mental health services and so forth that will be coming through here, don't actually happen. And I think there's a way that they can do that, both by making cuts, but also as taking a look at reducing some corporate loopholes.
Do you fear an impact on mental health services particularly?
Well, I think that is one of the things that is being looked at as potential cuts that could be coming to the state of Michigan. Again, you know, part of what the governor had talked about as part of his reason to do Medicaid expansion was to actually help redefine our mental health services. Unfortunately, both games in Washington, D.C. could be hurting that, but then also the games here at our state capitol. You might remember a few weeks ago, the state house passed the state federal partnership exchange for the Affordable Care Act. Right now, it's lingering in the Senate, and some people have said that it won't move. Again, this was going to bring hundreds of millions of people, new opportunities. I think it was a total of 400 million people would have access to health care that don't have it right now. And it's unfortunate that these political games, both on a national level, but we're also seeing it here at the Lansing State Capitol, are impacting good policy and helping our people that are in most of need.
Anything to say, pardon me, anything to say about a Democratic candidate in the 23rd Senate District?
I think there's a lot of people looking at that seat. I'm not one of those people looking at running for that seat at this point in time. I'm quite comfortable being in the state house, but I know that there's a number of people who are looking at it.
A new Main Street Strategies poll shows Congressman Gary Peters, who was on our show last week, enjoys a double-digit lead among Democrats for Michigan's U.S. Senate seat to be determined next year. Peters got 25% of the vote. Congressman Bart Stupak came in second with 12%. Debbie Dingell and Mark Schauer are tied for third with 9%, but 45% are still undecided. Any response to how that is playing out?
Well, I think from a state perspective, obviously you just asked me about my state senator, and so that's been a lot of conversation over the last few weeks. But obviously since Senator Carl Levin made his decision to retire, that's been the conversation in Democratic circles across the state. Everywhere I go, people are asking who's positioning themselves for that. I do think Congressman Gary Peters is probably the best suited for that, you know, coming off of a very strong couple of victories in the House, having legislative experience, having kind of the fundraising experience, and I think having the ability to campaign in a very tough race. I think he brings independents and even some leaning conservatives to his base, and I think you saw that in that poll. And so I'd be surprised if our candidate come next year for U.S. Senate isn't Gary Peters.
Is that right? Okay. Any thoughts? Who does that leave for governor then?
Well, I think there's a number of great candidates out there, a number of former congressional members, people like Mark Schauer, you know, Congressman Bart Stupak's name is out there. I think some of the names you've mentioned for U.S. Senate are other names. And I think, again, it's still early. I think by the summertime, we'll be more clear with gubernatorial candidates. And that's about the right time where we need to be taking a look at the 2014 election.
Our guest has been East Lansing State Representative Sam Singh. Tomorrow, he and Lansing State Rep Andy Shore gather to talk about the impact of sequestration at the Capitol at 9:30. Sam, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Today, we're really pleased to announce the beginning of our partnership with the Knight Center for Environmental Journalism here at MSU. It's one of the oldest programs of its kind in the country, and they produce the excellent online environmental news site Great Lakes Echo. Now, with this partnership, we'll be featuring conversations about environmental issues in Michigan and the Great Lakes region every Tuesday. In addition, we'll be bringing you original feature reports in the months to come from around the state of Michigan. To kick it off, we take a look at plastic floating in the Great Lakes. Scientists have conducted extensive research on the plastic-filled gyres of the ocean. Those are the swirling clusters of debris that you're apt to see in any body of water. But this summer, researchers decided to look inland and measure plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. Some of the Great Lakes water samples had concentrations of plastic greater than that anywhere else in the world. The studies resulted in several other projects which focus on the sources and the effects of plastic pollution on the Great Lakes. We're joined today by the study's leader, Dr. Sherry Mason. Sherry is a chemistry professor at the State University of New York at Fredonia. Welcome to Current State.
Hi, thank you for having me.
There are a substantial number of studies by this Five Gyres Institute, which detail oceanic plastic pollution, but the study you conducted last year is really the first to look inland and research plastic pollution in our Great Lakes. First, can you explain your research method and what exactly were you looking for?
So we collaborated with the Five Gyres Institute, and we were surveying the open waters. So there is one research group who has been looking at like near shore, essentially beachline studies of plastic debris, but we were the first to look within the open water of the Great Lakes. We use what's called a manta trawl, and it just kind of coasts along the surface layer of the water, and it's a giant net. And as the, you know, water runs through it, anything that's bigger than a third of a millimeter will be collected by the net. We run it for an hour at a time at 2 knots, so we go about 2 miles of sampling with each sample. And we pull it in, we take anything that's within the net, and we bring it back to the lab for more thorough analysis.
Well, and what are some of the dangers, the immediate dangers of plastic pollution?
Well, I mean, there's the direct effect, which is simply, you know, that if there's plastic in your water and, you know, life relies on water, that it could make its way into the food chain. And this, again, has been bore out in kind of the oceanic studies where, you know, you find albatross birds in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and their guts are entirely filled with plastic. Similarly with sea turtles and various you know, sperm whales and fish and all sorts of marine life in the ocean. So we know it's an issue within the oceans. We, you know, suspect that it's probably a similar issue within the Great Lakes, but we're just kind of getting started because, you know, our research was the first to actually show that there were plastics within the Great Lakes, although it wasn't a huge surprise in many ways. 35 million people live within the Great Lakes watershed. Most of us, if not all of us, use and lose plastic. You know, I probably every single one of your listeners can think of a moment when they've seen a plastic bag blowing in the wind. They've seen, you know, a cigarette lighter on the side of the street. And most of us, when we see these things, we just don't really necessarily think about what happens to them. And the reality is that they make their way into our water supply. And so they can be taken in by any organism that relies on that water. We tend to look at fish and birds because they are kind of the direct link. But, you know, certainly all of us drink water, too. So the concern is that it makes its way into the food, into the food web. And for animals that rely on that water, kind of the first impact is that it can give them a cessation that they're filled. It, you know, fills up their stomachs. They no longer think that they're hungry or thirsty, and they starve or dehydrate to death as a result of taking in that plastic directly. But there's an indirect effect as well.
Let's talk about what you found in Lake Erie. One of your findings that really stands out is the amount of plastic you found in part of the water samples from Lake Erie. The number of plastic particles in the sample was 3 times greater than any sample collected anywhere else in the world, correct?
That is correct, yeah. So we sampled Lake Superior, Lake Huron, and Lake Erie. We took a total of 21 samples between those three Great Lakes, about 8 samples in each lake. So it's not an extensive study. It's the first study, and so I think it lays an important groundwork. But certainly, you know, we didn't sample, as much of the surface area as we would like, and those are, you know, kind of steps that we plan to take in future endeavors. But one, you know, a trend that was definitely kind of noticeable, and we really wanted to sample three, you know, to sample more of the Great Lakes so that we could look at how the lakes compare to one another. And we definitely saw a trend where Lake Erie, where there was an increase in plastics as you go from Lake Superior to Lake Huron to Lake Erie. Lake Erie, by far of the three lakes that we looked at, had the highest concentrations. There were 2 samples out of the 21 that showed extremely high concentrations, even relative to what you find in oceanic samples, and both of those were in Lake Erie.
And how much do we know, Sherry, about how all of this plastic is ending up in the Great Lakes?
Well, there's always ongoing investigations about that, but I mean the reality is it's those pieces of plastic that we see lying along the side of the road, that we see, you know, floating in the air. It's the litter in the ground. It makes its way, you know, down storm drains. Storm drains are very different than, say, like a sewage system. A sewage, you know, system goes through a wastewater treatment plant, so there's the possibility that the plastics could be removed. But storm drains don't. They typically just discharge directly into a nearby water body. And so that plastic bag that you see blowing in the wind will eventually make its way into our water supply and travel and break down into smaller and smaller pieces as it goes. It, you know, one thing about plastics I think that's really important to note is that unlike many materials, they don't biodegrade. They will photodegrade, so they'll break apart, they'll get brittle, and they'll break into smaller and smaller pieces, but the integrity of the polymer molecule is maintained. So it never really goes away. So every plastic that we've ever produced, since the 1950s, is still on this planet somewhere. And what's scary is that as we're investigating this issue, whether we're talking about the oceans or the Great Lakes, is we're discovering that quite a bit of that plastic is in our water.
Very quickly, Sherry, we've got to wrap up. What are your summer research plans?
So this summer we're going back out on the lakes. We're going to be looking at Lake Erie again because it was, you know, the most concentrated of the ones that we looked at last summer.
Okay.
But I also have plans to be in the St. Lawrence Seaway and Lake Ontario, kind of the next step down from Lake Erie. We might expect to see Lake Ontario has higher concentrations than Lake Erie. And then, you know, the St. Lawrence Seaway, we're really curious how much of what we find in the Great Lakes is actually flowing out into the Atlantic Ocean.
Okay. We've got to leave it there, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, that's okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Sherry Mason teaches chemistry at State University of New York at Fredonia. Her research focuses on plastic pollution in the Great Lakes. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Coming up on the second half of Current State, Lansing rental properties going smoke-free. Are there enough smoke-free rental properties in Lansing? We'll find out from Dr. Renee Canaday of the Ingham County Health Department coming up on Current State. It's Current State. Thanks for joining us. This is 90.5 WKAR, and I'm Mark Bayshore. The Michigan Humanities Council will have a new executive director starting in May. Eric Nordberg is a longtime board member and will be coming to Lansing from Michigan Technological University, where he most recently served as the university archivist. He spoke with WKAR's Melissa Benmark.
Well, the Michigan Humanities Council is a cultural organization. We're a statewide nonprofit. We receive money from the National Endowment for the Humanities, a federal agency. And their process in designing the NEH was that they were going to provide funds to a nonprofit in each state that can work with developing various types of cultural planning in their area. So rather than giving it to a state agency, the money goes to a nonprofit, which in our case is the Michigan Humanities Council. We use that money to do a number of different things. One of the things that most people know us for is that we do give out a fair amount of that money as grants to small agencies that undertake various types of projects, sometimes exhibits, sometimes public programming of various sorts. But then the council also runs its own programs statewide, and we can talk about those in more detail.
People tend to be fairly familiar with the arts councils, but define what exactly encompasses humanities. What kinds of things do you deal with in terms of the exhibits and programs you're talking about?
Well, I think it's always been a challenge for humanities people to define the word humanities. Very often they will put it as a counter to the arts. We think about the arts and we think about songs, music, maybe performance types of things or art where we, you know, where we might paint something or do sculpture. The humanities are really more of the thinking portion of some of that. We deal with history, literature, philosophy, things like the law and politics, all those things that help to define who we are as people. In some cases, it might help to kind of identify different groups of people throughout our culture, but very often it also identifies the things that we have in common, things like religion and the way that we think about the world, kind of our identity.
How did you come to be involved with the Humanities Council?
Well, I've actually been working for 20 years as an archivist, so in the work of collecting historical records at a couple of different agencies. Most recently, I've been working at Michigan Technological University in Houghton, Michigan, in the Upper Peninsula. Here at Michigan Tech, we've been involved in collecting the historical records of copper mining in the region. Most people know about the copper country of Michigan and its historic mining district. So in that role as a person who collects historical documents, we've actually been pretty active as well in showing how historians and other people can use materials to understand what happened in this area before now. So doing various types of exhibits, sometimes speaker programs, a lot of things now with digital initiatives online so that people can understand the history of our region. And then that was a kind of a natural progression for me. I actually served on the governing board of the Michigan Humanities Council for 8 years, got involved in a lot of their programming and activities, and so when this position opened up, it seemed like a natural fit for me to apply.
Is your particular personal interest, your area, the Copper Age in the UP, or what is your personal interest in humanities?
The work that I've done here at Michigan Tech has been very tied to the story of copper in Michigan. Personally, I've had a great deal of interest in history. I was one of those kids that followed my father around with those AAA triptychs as we made trips across the United States and stopped at various historic places. So I've always had a real interest in history. I've personally taken that to the point now where I'm actually pursuing a doctoral degree here at Michigan Tech in industrial history and archaeology. So I have an interest in pursuing that as an area of study myself.
What do you see as some of your priorities while you're at the helm of the council?
As a nonprofit that receives funding from the federal government, and we also receive support from the state of Michigan through the Michigan Council of Arts and Cultural Affairs, I think it's always important that as a director, we're very transparent about the expenditure of public dollars. I think that's always important. But I think also it's a matter of trying to reach out to collaborators across the state to find out what are the needs right now as we move forward. I think agencies across Michigan are struggling right now with various aspects of the financial slowdown that we've experienced. So what is it that the Michigan Humanities Council can do to help to coordinate those kinds of activities or help to explore those kinds of stories? You know, I grew up in the Detroit area. I lived in South Bend, Indiana, so down near the southwestern corner of Michigan. My parents are from the Straits area, so I've spent a lot of time there. Now I'm in the Upper Peninsula for a good number of years. So I have a feeling about some of the issues across the state of Michigan, and I'm wondering how do we explore those topics? How do we explore topics like the changes in the industrial and commercial emphasis of Michigan over the last 20 years? How do we discuss and explore this kind of idea of Michigan being partly this industrial state, but also this kind of up north place that has a wonderful scenery and different types of commerce and industry in northern Michigan and the Upper Peninsula? I think those are the kinds of stories that I'm interested in exploring and looking to see how do we connect them with other collaborators, historical societies, universities, colleges, libraries, schools, to help people kind of get an understanding of how these things affect the state that we live in.
What are some of the programs that the Michigan Humanities Council is currently responsible for?
You know, we just announced a new book for our Great Michigan Read. It's called Annie's Ghost, and it's going to be a real interesting project over the course of the next year and a half with an author's tour. The book is about he's a Washington Post writer. He's originally from the Detroit area. And after his mother's death, it's a nonfiction book, he discovers that his mother had a sister that he never knew about. And it turned out that she had some developmental problems and some physical handicaps, and the family decided to put her into an institution. And the mother just kind of stopped talking about her, never told her kids, never told most of the extended family. And so he goes through this process of kind of uncovering the story of his lost aunt. It has nice tie-ins, I think, to a lot of the conversations we're all having about how to deal with people with mental illness and also the kind of changes over time and how we've dealt with institutions and treating people.
That was Eric Nordberg. He's the incoming executive director of the Michigan Humanities Council. Speaking with WKAR's Melissa Benmark, Nordberg starts his new position in May. Tomorrow is National Kick Butts Day. Despite its catchy title, it's got nothing to do with mixed martial arts or achieving your personal best on Xbox. It's a day of activism to call attention to the hazards of tobacco use. Here in mid-Michigan, the managers of a local apartment complex are marking the day by celebrating their recent status as a smoke-free property. Current State's Kevin Lavery has more.
Fred Meyer gives a warm greeting to every tenant he sees on a snowy afternoon at Marsh Point Apartments in Hazlett.
Hello, Ms. Dorothy.
Well, hello.
How are you?
Meyer is the community manager at Marsh Point, which caters to residents aged 55 and older. As you might expect, some are in fragile health, so the management company, KMG Prestige, officially made the complex smoke-free 2 weeks ago. Fred Meyer and I talked about the trend towards smoke-free rental housing, which was virtually unheard of just a decade ago.
We've allowed smoking up till March 1st, and now it's a non-smoking property. We're not asking people to quit smoking, we're asking them to stop smoking in the building.
What were the reasons that drove that decision?
Well, the health risks of smoking are widely publicated, and We feel that the cost to turn over an apartment that's been smoked in is far more expensive than one that's been smoke-free. It's so expensive to get the odor out. It's frequently you have to replace the carpet as well as prime the entire apartment and then paint it twice to get that smell out.
Now, up until this time, how many residents do you think you had who were smokers?
I would say less than 10%.
So not a big chunk of the population here?
No, and the fallout's been pretty minor. I think maybe we had one or two people that weren't going to stay because of the smoking issue, but most people are pretty happy where they are, and smoking or not, they want to stay here.
I was looking online, and you may be familiar with the Center for Social Gerontology in Ann Arbor, and they actually run a website, mismokefreeapartment.org. I was surprised to learn that if you're not a smoker, if you have some sort of a respiratory disability, you have legal protection not to be in a smoke environment.
Yes, so smokers are not a protected class. They don't really have any rights. Other people that are affected by it certainly can voice their opinions to apartment management. And that is a good resource for landlords to get information to go smoke-free.
Smoke-free housing, even a decade or so ago, was much harder to come by, and it seems that the trend economically is that it's becoming really the norm. It's being very much driven by customer demand.
Yes, it has been, and it's really an excellent marketing point being a non-smoking property. There's just far more people that aren't smoking these days than are, and it's really been a good advertising point for us.
Fred Meyer is the community manager at Marsh Point Apartments in Hazlitt. Mr. Meyer, thank you for your time today.
Nice talking to you, Kevin.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And I'm joined now by Ingham County Health Officer Dr. Renee Kennedy to talk some more about smoke-free housing in mid-Michigan. Thanks for joining us, Renee.
Nice to
see you again.
You too, Mark.
Ingham Health Department reports that 90% of the population in Michigan want smoke-free housing, but only 13% of the housing stock is actually smoke-free on the inside. What accounts for this shortage? Do you know?
Well, let me enunciate the statistics a little more, which is really amazing
okay.
to me. 22% of our population identify as smokers in this county. But even among those 22%, because we know that 6% of the population, only 6% allow smoking in their homes, that suggests to us that even some smokers want the availability of smoke-free housing.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there's a 16% discrepancy
yes,
there.
Yes, there is. So there is, when we look at MSHDA's database, they identify about 13% of the housing in our jurisdiction as smoke-free. And we know that about 94% of people want smoke-free housing.
Okay. What is the Ingham Health Department doing to work with local housing officials and landlords to make sure there's more smoke-free properties?
Well, we're working very carefully as a part of a regional substance abuse and smoking coalition to partner with private agencies like KMG Prestige, who you heard from. We also were really instrumental in working in 2011 with the Lansing Housing Commission, which now has all of its units as smoke-free, the Lansing Housing Coalition, where all of their sites are now smoke-free, really is about educating and informing people about the risk of passive smoke.
Nothing is more grotesque, for a non-smoker anyway, than walking into a space that has obviously been smoked in over time. Can those apartments be cleaned up adequately? Can that be thoroughly cleaned out of an apartment?
Well, they can be cleaned out adequately. It is a matter of how much financial investment the landlords want to put into that. You know, I think even when you talk about a property that's been a smoking facility, if I rent an apartment that was not smoking, but three doors down, they were smokers, this is a very permeable chemical.
Exactly.
So the walls, it goes through the walls, it goes through the air sockets, it goes through the drop ceilings. So my perception of having a smoke-free apartment may not be if my neighbors are also not smoke-free.
It's interesting because on a hot summer day, there's nobody who likes his car air conditioning more than I do. But the one drawback to that is how sensitive those units are to if you're driving by another car being driven by a smoker with his window rolled down and your air conditioning is on, it permeates your
amazing.
Space. It is incredible how potent it is in that respect. Fred Meyer talked about how smoke-free housing makes good economic sense for landlords from a public health perspective. What's your take on that idea?
Well, there is a lot of misperception that this will hurt business. What we've seen from the evidence, from the research, is that it does not. And what we're trying to do as a local health department is to make the healthy choice the easy choice. It should be smoke-free living opportunities should be readily available, mm-hmm. As opposed to having to seek and ask and inquire. We're trying to normalize that as the standard.
Last year, your team produced one of the most comprehensive reports on public health in mid-Michigan. What progress has been made in disease prevention and health maintenance since the report?
Well, we are at the very exciting stages of that report now, where each of the constituents, our local hospitals, and each of the three local health departments are now in the process of developing what we call a community health improvement plan. So we will be looking at what we individually will do and how we will come together over the collectively to fight the priorities that we've identified. So stay tuned. We're in the think tank stage of how we'll implement now.
No, you must have an idea as to what is specifically going to be a part of that plan. You and I have talked at length about obesity in the past and other health issues in Ingham County. What do you think will be at the top of that report? What's going to be at the center of it?
Well, child well-being is one of the big factors, and each of our agencies are looking at that a little distinctly. I mean, certainly our emphasis is infant mortality. We're doing a lot with a couple of new programs. For example, our partner at Sparrow Hospital, they are looking at childhood obesity. So we are each talking with our individual constituents in our workforce to see what particularly can we do about those areas. And we'll look forward to keeping you informed as we progress.
Okay. Did anything in that report jump out at you when you got it?
You know, it did not. But it is always good to have evidence to guide our decision making. The fact that obesity is a problem, the fact that safety was a concern for our constituents might be surprising, but not necessarily. And so we'll continue to tease that out and look at what we can each do to contribute to the overall well-being.
Dr. Renee Kennedy is the Ingham County Health Officer, and we've been talking about smoke-free housing and other issues here in mid-Michigan. Always nice to see you.
You too, Mark. Thank you.
Tomorrow morning, the spring equinox occurs just after 7 a.m. Eastern Time. Detroit area native, composer and musician Patrick Grant has created seasonal music celebrations in his adopted home of New York City. Patrick's event entitled Tilted Axes rung in the winter equinox of 2012, or rather strummed in the season. Dozens of electric guitarists hooked portable amplifiers to their belts and walked the streets of Manhattan to observe the arrival of winter. Now, Patrick brings the Tilted Axes celebration to downtown Detroit to hail the spring of 2013 as 22 electric guitarists joined together for the musical happening. WKAR's Peter Wharf spoke with Grant yesterday. Patrick began the conversation by comparing New York's winter Tilted Axes activities with tomorrow's event.
And the funny thing is that when I did this last December, I've been doing this for the winter solstices in New York, I thought, like, man, I got to do this at a time of year where it's a little warmer.
Right.
And here we are, approaching the first day of spring in Detroit. It's exactly the same weather that it was in New York back in December, but I know it can be done. But we're going to start out at the Charles H. Wright Museum of African American History, which I think is historically perfect. It's poetic in the sense, because anybody, no matter who they are, if they're playing any kind of rock music or any kind of music that has a backbeat, they owe that to the African-American tradition, you know, from which all that music came. You know, they talk about, you know, Elvis is the king of rock, but I would correct them. I go back to, like, Little Richard or Chuck Berry, you know.
Yeah.
If they really want to talk about historical accuracy. So we're starting out there. We're going to, you know, we're going to go to the steps of the DIA. We're going to wind our way to the lunchtime crowds of the Wayne State University campus. We're going to come down the Cass Corridor, and then we're going to go all the way down as far south as the Motor City Majestic Theater, and we're going to come all the way up past the Detroit Artist Market, and we're going to end, again, on the steps of the DIA in front of the Thinker. They're going to see 22 guitarists and a percussionist. We all wear aqua bandanas, just to sort of, that's the only costume we have. And I tell people, you can wear it any way you want. You can wear it on your head, around your ankle, you know, hang it from your guitar. That's up to them. And we do have a procession banner. So that's helpful for the people on the street. We'll say, like, what the heck is this? And we'll say, you know, it's the Tilted Axe of Detroit procession for the first day of spring. And then we have we don't have a stage manager. We have a woman who is what we call a tilt manager. And when we go to all these different sections of the piece, and when we stop, every piece has a title, but she has, you know, big cards that she holds up. So it not only helps cue the musicians as to where we're going, but we can also inform the public as to just add more to it, you know, give the names to pieces. Everyone always asks the question, like, what is that called?
What does Tilted Axes mean?
Yeah, I've been saying it so much, it's probably worth explaining. Well, since this began at the solstice, the reason why we have four seasons is because of the axial tilt of the Earth. So I'm calling it Tilted Axes because an axe is also a popular slang, you know, name for a guitar or, you know, whatever a person's instrument happens to be. But in this case, I'm applying it toward the guitar, so that's why it's Tilted Axes.
What kind of reaction have you received in the past from people on the street who see and hear you?
A lot of cheers. For some reason, people seem to think like we're doing it just for them. You know, I don't know what's like. I've heard people say like, "Wow, it's my birthday! Thank you, thank you, thank you!" And then there's other people who just start running alongside us saying, "This is awesome! This is awesome!" It's like, okay, you know. But you know, in a Pied Piper kind of fashion, we'll often pick up people who will actually want to like walk along the procession route with us. So it's usually a pretty good crew. And one of the things I'll say about the guitarists is I really put them through their paces in terms of the music has to be learned and all of it memorized, you know, in a pretty much three rehearsals. I try to program the procession that it might start out with some of the easier pieces and then we'll work into the harder ones. But definitely, every time we've done this, by the time we get to the end of the procession, that ensemble knows the piece is cold. And for me, I've always liked music with lots of layers and lots of parts. So whether it's, you know, a Baroque counterpoint or, you know, Balinese gamelan, I just find great joy in seeing, like, a lot of people, you know, playing parts that fit together so well, like all the, you know, pieces of a finely made watch. And to me, that's a great metaphor for how things work when they do work well. And not just for in music, but in everything in what we call life.
Patrick Grant is a New York City composer and musician and Detroit area native. Tilted Axes begins Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. in downtown Detroit. You can find out more about the event at peppergreenmedia.com. That's peppergreen, one word, media.com. Patrick, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
For Current State, this is Peter Wharf.
And we want to wish the MSU women's basketball team luck in the postseason here. We found out that we are a number 5 seed. We're going to be busy Saturday against Marist. So good luck to Susie and all of the rest of the Spartan women on the women's basketball team. Coming up Wednesday on Current State, we'll discuss the future of nuclear arms and a look at the spring long-range weather forecast. That and more tomorrow here on Current State. The executive producer of our show is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is Current State's producer. Thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and Gabriella Saldivia and Sonia Treweiler for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Alumni Association, offering opportunities for networking, career services, and community involvement with MSU alumni in your area and across the country. alumni.msu.edu. And by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet. Insured by NCUA.